From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. What do we do with the devil among us? Not, you know, a metaphorical Satan or Lucifer. I mean real people who've committed real atrocities. Terrorists. Serial killers. People we'd all agree are, well, evil. But what if they repent, ask for forgiveness, seem to truly seek atonement? What do you do with a former Liberian warlord who wants to help the families of his victims? All 20,000 of them. What do you do with them? Is it possible to have sympathy for the devil? First, Jack Abramoff. Hardly a murderer, but to many in the Beltline, he is the devil incarnate. Senator Conrad Burns said, "I wish he'd never been born." Congresswoman Deborah Price said, "He is a creep, and we hate him." Paul Begler summed it up when he said on Crossfire, "Jack Abramoff, he's scum." How did this guy earn such vitriol? Jack Abramoff was the notorious lobbyist at the center of one of Washington's most far-reaching corruption scandals. He served 4 years for fraud, tax evasion, and conspiracy to bribe public officials. His testimony brought down dozens of other public and elected officials. Abramoff is out of jail now, and he told Ann Strangchamps he intends to spend the rest of his life making amends.
I came to a different view of myself and of the system I participated in over time. This has been over 8 years that this has been going on. When it first started, frankly, there were articles in the Washington Post, and the discussion at my law firm was, do we post these articles on the firm website? They were really nothing out of the ordinary at first. As things
When the first articles, mm-hmm. like the Washington Post articles accusing mm-hmm. you of influence peddling and unfair influence, you thought of putting those on your website?
Yeah. To a lobbyist in that system, basically the article said that I had a lot of influence, I charged a lot of money, and I was very powerful. And, you know, that's how in those days, that's the prism through which I would read those articles. And frankly, the people around me did. And it's kind of ironic, almost kind of gallows humor, that we actually had a discussion on email the next morning. Should we post this article on the website? That's just how out of it we were. How
did
deep
you?
In the forest we were. No, we didn't, because we didn't like the headline and we didn't like the picture. I mean, think about how superficial that analysis is, but tragically, that's where we were holding.
But that's such an interesting place that, you know, so you're at this place where the first headlines are coming out and you don't feel guilt. You don't think, oh my gosh, they found me, I'm breaking all the laws. Obviously, I mean, there's some part of you that thinks I'm just doing what everybody else does.
Well, my first reaction beyond, should we put this on the website, was, what's the big deal? This will blow over. It's Washington. Things blow over. Everybody's got ADD, you know, in Washington. So there'll be something else that come along. And after a week or two, this will be out of the headlines and nobody will care. That was my first real reaction. And that obviously didn't happen as I started getting pummeled day in and day out. And hearings were being called in the House and the Senate and just all sorts of things were going on. And my next reaction was, what in the world is this? You know, well, why me? You know, what have I done that's any different than anybody else? I'm just playing the system as I learned it. And that was my reaction for a little bit longer until I finally said, you know what, I better take an honest look at this and at myself and what I did. And I started to go through with my attorneys the emails that I wrote. And I came to the realization, number one, that yes, indeed, I went over the line. I broke the law. And as I started to see that, in fact, I was wrong. I broke the law. I did things that I'm ashamed of, that I shouldn't have been doing. I frankly shouldn't have been in the system. What was I doing there? I started over time, and I'm talking months and months, and it turned into years and years of rethinking everything. By the time, even before I got to prison, I had frankly come to the epiphany that I was not only guilty, I was wrong. I was wrong in terms of what was illegal, but worse, because 99% of what I did was frankly legal. I was wrong in what was legal. I entered prison knowing that, frankly, I unfortunately probably belonged there.
So like what? I mean, what specifically are you embarrassed mm-hmm. about or feel ashamed of?
Well, I legally didn't quote-unquote bribe anyone, but of course I bribe people. It goes on every day. Anytime a lobbyist or a lobbyist's client conveys a financial interest to a public servant, with the interest of that public servant doing something on their behalf, it's a bribe. And so I was deeply enmeshed in a system of legalized bribery that's shameful and that's wrong and that I'm working at this point in my life to do everything I can to change.
Will you play out for, you know, those of us who don't work on Capitol Hill, I mean, how does this work? You know, let's say I want a vote passed by a representative. What do you do?
Well, usually you hire a lobbyist because most people can't come directly, spend the time to develop the relationships necessary to gain the access to make their points. Lobbying is all about access. Can you get in the room with the decision maker? Part two of lobbying, of course, is being persuasive. But if you're not in the room, if you're not talking to the person making the decision, I don't care how persuasive you are, it doesn't matter. So step one in lobbying, get in the room, get the access. And that, unfortunately, not everyone, but for the most part, those who have tremendous access, garner it because of giving money, raising money politically for congressmen, taking them on trips, going with them on trips, playing golf, sharing meals, giving them sports tickets, etc. Basically all the components of bribery. And that's how that is done. So if you have something you want changed, you're going to hire a lobbyist who has the best access on Capitol Hill to the congressman who is important to you. And that individual, you're going to rely on them to make sure that they have the kind of access, frankly, that you and everyone else isn't going to normally get. It's only going to be gotten because they are important financially to that member of Congress and their staff. And that access is the corrupting part of lobbying, that when using money to gain that access, and that's indeed what is bribery.
The way you describe it, like golf games, tickets to sports events, frankly, it doesn't sound all that, like, it just doesn't sound like that big a deal. But I think what we're missing is the epic scale on which you did this. I mean, you paid millions of dollars in, I don't know, for sports tickets alone, right?
Yeah, I just want to say, though, that it is a big deal, and it's not necessarily about only the scale. I was operating on a scale that was, frankly, ridiculous, but that's a personality defect I have. I had a mantra of if it's worth doing, it's worth overdoing. And so instead of buying four tickets, let's just say, to the Redskins game, I had 72 tickets. Instead of having just some seats at the Wizards basketball game, I had 40 tickets, you know, that kind of thing. I overdid it. I didn't take people on meals. I owned restaurants. I didn't take them playing golf. I put them on an airplane and took them to St. Andrews, the old course, to play golf. So I overdid it. But the issue isn't the Jack Abramoffs of the world. Jack Abramoff got punished for overdoing it and for going over the line as I did. The issue is that every gratuity, even things that don't sound like a big deal, are helping to corrode the system. The fact that it doesn't sound like a big deal, by the way, is indeed what people on Capitol Hill believe. You will hear constantly a member of Congress say, no one's going to buy my vote for a $2,000 contribution or a meal or a ticket to the Redskins or something like that. The truth is that the relationship is created where the public servant has gratitude, if they're a decent person, has gratitude to those who give them anything.
Mm. That gratitude you referred to, you used to talk about owning people. Is that what you mean? They feel indebted to you?
What I would talk about is having so much influence in an office that you literally owned it, where I noticed that when I offered a job to, say, a chief of staff, and they were going to come join me in a year at the lobbying firm. And I should just note that virtually everybody I dealt with up there wanted to work for me, wanted to move over to K Street and become a lobbyist and make much more money. So whenever I did offer a job, I noticed at that moment, whenever they accepted it, from that moment until the day they came to join me, and it could again be a year or more, they were working for me already. That's how the kind of control that a lobbyist can have over a real vice grip over a congressional office can take place.
And how many, I don't know, when you think about how many Senate and congressional offices and how many of those did you have staff you thought you owned?
Well, probably 100 offices we felt that we had serious impact in their offices. And then beyond that, probably a total, I don't know, about 300 offices that we had some impact. I mean, a top lobbying firm, people have to understand something. The lobbying firms in Washington, the top tier, and we were at the top tier, their full-time job is obtaining access, working the access, maintaining the access, and doing everything they can to make sure they can get in and get offices to help them and do what they want. And they do it in large part through raising money. money. I raised millions of dollars a year through my clients and others and got it to members of Congress who were helpful to my clients. People have to realize that this is what goes on. This is their stock and trade. And so they spend their full time doing it.
So here's the thing that I'd never understand. You know, I've read a lot of stories about you, and everybody's very focused on, I mean, you are the big bad guy. You are the poster boy for, you know, corrupt Washington, D.C. But all those guys you quote-unquote owned, all those senators and congressional people and their staffs, they took what you offered. I mean, you didn't hold a gun to their heads or anything, right?
No, I didn't.
So I don't understand. I mean, who's corrupt? To me, there's, you know, you may have been the devil incarnate offering temptation, but they took it.
Yeah, I mean, clearly it takes two to tango in Washington, at least two to tango, and people are on both sides of that equation. But again, don't forget, 99% of the things I did were legal. All right, so people ask, why aren't there a bunch of people in jail? Because it's not illegal. That's the problem. It is legal. This needs to change, and I'm working right now very hard with some of the reform groups, particularly United Republic, to change this and to change the rules, because these rules, by the way, are drawn by the very people who intend later to go become lobbyists. So obviously they're not going to draw them too tightly. And so and they benefit from them while they sit in there. So the rules need to be changed. People didn't go down with me because there weren't a lot of people who had to go, who felt a need to go over the line. Frankly, I was stupid. I didn't need to go over the line either, but I did. And had I not, I might still be up there doing it, tragically. So in a certain respect, for me, it was beneficial. I mean, this was a horrific experience. Please let me not say anything else. But in a certain way, I thank God that that I was taken out of there. And unfortunately, it was not easy for me anymore, by the way, than it's easy for any of the others who are currently doing it, to sit back and say, you know what, we shouldn't be doing this. This is wrong. This system is destroying the country. I didn't do that for a minute. I really regret it. I wish, by the way, I could say to you, I did. I wish I didn't have to say the shameful thing that it took my head getting cut off for me to realize I was wrong. You know, that says something very bad about me, I guess. And, you know, it's something I'm trying to work on.
So I'm curious about the personal part of coming back from something like that, not so much in the, you know, the public sense, but I guess I'm thinking about personal redemption. Do you forgive yourself? Do you not? Do you try to atone? I mean, what is this process
like? Well, I certainly try to atone. I've been trying to atone every day since I came to the epiphany that I was wrong. The first step in atonement is, first of all, realizing that you've done something wrong. Because many people, including, by the way, many of the men I spent time in prison with, didn't ever come to that first step, didn't even realize that they did something wrong and admit it to themselves, at least, if not to everybody else, at least to themselves. The second step being having regret that, yeah, I did something wrong and I regret it. That's a very important second step. The third step gets more difficult, you know, trying to somehow repair the wrong you did. With me, it's very difficult to do that because, you know, how do I repair it? Now, part of it I'm trying to do now. I'm trying to speak out and help change the system, at least, that I was involved in. I'm trying quietly to help repair those that were involved in my situation, you know, where appropriate I can, you know, and legal, I can step in and help. I'm paying restitution financially, which in an immense amount to those who were wronged. And finally,
that's in the millions, am I right?
44 million, yes. And yeah, it's a lot. I mean, I'm certainly going to be paying that for the rest of my life. But even if I weren't paying it for the rest of my life, there won't be a day in my life, and there hasn't been a day in my life, when I don't think about these things, think about what was it about me that enabled me to do all, you know, these things, to get into this world, and fight those impulses that are deeply embedded. You know, change a human personality characteristic is one of the most difficult things in the world, and it requires constant vigilance, and I'm trying. And then finally, with us, in terms of finding the final step of repentance and atonement, if you get put back into the same situation, how do you behave? I don't expect to be put back into the same situation. I'm not going to become a lobbyist again, and I don't expect anybody would want me to be a lobbyist again, certainly not those folks on Capitol Hill. So I don't know what will be the test that eventually I'll get where I'll be able to resist going down the path that I went down, but I hope it comes, and I hope I pass that test.
Jack Abramoff has written a book called Capital Punishment, The Hard Truth About Washington Corruption from America's Most Notorious Lobbyist. Ann Strangechamp spoke with him. If you want to hear Ann's uncut interview with Jack Abramoff, please go to our website at ttbook.org. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. This hour, we're talking about having sympathy for the devil. And there's one devil we never sympathize with, the terrorist. But hold on, not so fast, says filmmaker Marshall Curry. His documentary, If a Tree Falls, follows Daniel McGowan, a convicted terrorist, currently serving time. McGowan used arson as a political protest with the Earth Liberation Front, a group the FBI considers America's number one domestic terrorist threat. Steve Paulson spoke with filmmaker Marshall Curry about Daniel's story.
My wife, who was running a domestic violence organization in Brooklyn, came home from work one day and told me, "You're never going to guess what happened at work today. Four federal agents walked into the office and arrested that guy, Daniel McGowan." And I knew him a little bit through her, you know, from the company picnics and things like that. But he was very unlike my expectation of what somebody might be like who had been part of the Earth Liberation Front. And that was really what was intriguing to us. You know, obviously, my wife and I had no idea that he had this in his past. And he'd grown up in Rockaway, Queens. You know, his dad's a New York cop. He was a business major in college. So maybe not your typical radical environmentalist background.
Well, it seems to me one of the themes of your film is how a person becomes radicalized. I mean, how does a quote, normal person become so radicalized that he's willing to set off incendiary devices to blow up buildings?
Yeah, well, just to be clear, the devices that they did were not bombs, so they didn't actually explode, but they had timers that would light huge tubs of fuel that would cause these big fires. So not to downplay what it was, but just to be clear, they weren't bombs.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, that was really my question, is how could somebody whose background was like Daniel's wind up committing these huge multi-million dollar arsons? And you know, it's a coming-of-age story in certain ways. What happens?
I got out to Northern California. I had never seen trees like that before. It had a really profound impact on me. I was already quite radicalized, but I couldn't believe the fact that people accepted what was going on. I have memories of like for the first time seeing log trucks, you know, and being like, whoa. You saw the mills. Or you going into the forest and you stumble upon a clear cut. Like, it just blew me away. Just the arrogance of it. I was like, man, this is butchered. You know, it made me think, like, why are we being so gentle? Why are we so gentle in our activism when this is what's happening, you know? I think people have a very Pollyanna viewpoint of social change. No real social change has happened without pressure, without force, without, some would say, an intimidating governments and corporations into changing their behavior.
So take us through Daniel's own process of becoming radicalized. How did he go from someone who was just, you know, sort of marginally interested in environmental issues to taking such extreme measures?
Well, I think it was a combination of strong feelings for the environment, which came to him very late. You know, he had grown up in Queens and had gone to school in New York, had never spent the night outdoors until after college. And so one day he was out in Union Square and somebody asked him to sign a petition. And he started a conversation with her and she invited him to a place called Wetlands, which was a kind of a bar, concert hall, and environmental center that used to be in downtown Manhattan. And he went. And when he was there, he became exposed to all of the environmental problems that were facing the world. And they had speakers come. They had films there. And he began to feel like this was an incredibly important issue, the way that people are treating the environment. And so, you know, as he describes it, he got involved very, very quickly. And like a lot of folks, it started with letter writing and petition gathering. And over time, he began to feel like that wasn't really effective enough. And he got involved in civil disobedience and was arrested doing a sit-in, and eventually felt like that wasn't enough and got involved in small acts of property destruction, you know, breaking windows and things like that. And again, felt like that wasn't enough. And so he got involved with the Earth Liberation Front, which is, you know, this radical environmental group that is responsible for dozens of arsons all around the country, but during those years focused on the Northwest.
In Vail, Colorado, the nation's busiest ski resort was hit today by a fire. Arson is suspected.
You may have heard of the Earth Liberation Front. The Attorney General himself says it's a domestic terrorist organization. The FBI says it is one of the most dangerous groups in the country.
The ELF has claimed responsibility for more than two dozen major acts of eco-terrorism since 1996.
Firebombings include attacks on lumber mills, wild horse corrals, and two meatpacking plants.
So far, not one of the cases has ever been solved. And authorities acknowledge they know next to nothing about the membership or the leadership of the organization.
And it's worth pointing out that they set off some huge fires, I mean, that caused millions of dollars worth of damage in some cases. But as far as I know, no person was ever injured or killed in any of these acts of arson.
That's right. And that is one of the big debates of the film is how do we assess what these fires are? The government considered them to be terrorists, to consider the fires to be terrorism. And from the point of view of the arson victims, you know, who we spend a lot of time with in the film, these acts were designed to intimidate them, to terrorize them. And in some cases, they worked. I mean, one of the owners of the timber company said he didn't know if they were going to come after his family. He bought an alarm system for his house, which he'd never had before. And to him, that's the essence of terrorism, is when you use terror to try to force somebody to do something. From the point of view of folks who are more supportive of the Earth Liberation Front, they argue that this is not terrorism at all. This is the Boston Tea Party. It's symbolic property destruction. Nobody's ever been hurt in an Earth Liberation Front fire. And that's because they take great care to scope the places out and make sure that nobody's there. And, you know, in their minds, to use the same word to describe Al-Qaeda, which, you know, is a group designed to murder people, to use the same word to describe them and to describe the Earth Liberation Front is really kind of stretching the word terrorism.
Eco-terrorism. Terrorist acts by radical groups.
Eco-terrorists.
Eco-terrorism.
Environmental terrorists.
People need to question, like, this buzzword and how it's being used and how it's, like, just become the new communist. It's become the new, you know, it's like the boogeyman. It's a boogeyman word. It's like whoever I really disagree with is a terrorist.
Some people have the problem with, you know, calling this terrorism, but when you're basically making the threat where people go home at night wondering if they're going to be a target, that's what terrorism is.
After the fire, for a long time, you really looked over your shoulder. And we put an alarm system in our home and things like that that before we hadn't thought about.
You know, being a New Yorker with experiencing such serious terrorism firsthand is like, how are you going to call someone who sets fire to an empty building a terrorist? It's just inappropriate in every way, and it's an insult.
So at a certain point, Daniel himself felt like he had gone too far, that this was wrong, what he had done.
Yeah, it's funny. I think he feels very mixed about it. After that second fire, I think he began to feel like it was ineffective. And for one, he began to see that the media coverage focused entirely on the arsons and didn't focus on the things that they were trying to draw attention to. And everybody was just talking about whether they're going to catch these people or whether, you know, how long people would go to prison, whether it's terrorism. And that was not the conversation that I think they were hoping to spark. Made him take a deep breath and say, wait a minute, what am I doing? This is big. This is dangerous. And at that point, he stepped away from the Earth Liberation Front and moved back to New York and got involved in more above-ground activism. He worked at the Rainforest Foundation and was involved in protests against the Republican Convention when they were in New York. And finally was working at the domestic violence organization that my wife runs when he was arrested a few years after having done these fires.
Investigators in the Pacific Northwest strongly suspect that two nearly simultaneous fires were acts of ecological terror.
Monday morning, May 24th, I got back to Eugene and I was just like, wow, I really need to think about what I just did. Just seeing, you know, absolute ruins and realizing that, like, all people were going to focus on was the fact that things were destroyed and that the issues are being lost and all they care about is the catching the people that did it. They're talking about Jefferson Poplar and then they're talking about University of Washington. So finding out what eventually happened at University of Washington, the massive destruction to a library, not just the professor's office that was involved in this sort of research, but the Center for Urban Horticulture. I was like, this is too much, too fast, too big. What am I doing?
What kind of sentence did Daniel get in the end?
In the end, he got 7 years, which is significantly less than life in prison.
And he's still in prison right now.
He is in prison right now. It's a little bit more than – or not a little bit, almost twice as much as someone might normally get for similar acts of arson if, say, you'd burned a building for insurance money. But I think one of the things that's been interesting is that the prison where he is a communication management unit prison, which is essentially a terrorist prison that the federal government set up after 9/11. And he is isolated from the normal prison population. He is allowed a 15-minute phone call every week that's monitored, and he's allowed a single visit through bulletproof glass with, you know, a family member, an approved member, once a month. And so, you know, the government feels like they need to do that in order to monitor his terrorist threat. But from his perspective, that's incredibly frustrating. You know, he's a guy who had left the Earth Liberation Front on his own years before being arrested. And, you know, he feels like it's completely inappropriate that he would be in a terrorist prison treated like that.
So I have to ask you, do you think the arson cases that Daniel McGowan was involved in were justified?
I don't know. You know, there are times where I've been out, you know, in the forest and I've seen surveying stakes laid down in a beautiful old forest and realized, wait, this is being set here to prepare for this forest being cut down. And there's a side of me that would love to pull up those surveying stakes. I've spent a lot of time obviously thinking about this issue. And when I was in college, I studied religion. I really wanted to figure out if there was God and, you know, how we should live our lives. And I studied comparative religion. And when I graduated, one of my roommates said to me, I'm still confused, but just at a higher level. And in a way, that's on a lot of these issues, I still feel confused, but at a higher level. And I think they're complex. I don't think that they're the kinds of things that you can just, in the end, give a one-sentence answer that can be slapped on a bumper sticker or, you know, released as a soundbite. The reason that I made a 85-minute movie is because I feel like these questions are complex enough and nuanced enough that the best way to address them was in an 85-minute film. And if I sort of say, yes, sabotage is good, or no, sabotage is evil, I sort of feel like I undercut the real complexity that underpins the whole film.
Marshall Curry, talking about his documentary If a Tree Falls, a story of the Earth Liberation Front. The documentary was nominated for a 2012 Academy Award. Steve Paulson spoke with him. If you'd like to share this interview with a friend, or comment on it, or just hear it again, please join us on Twitter or Facebook. Listening to Daniel McGowan remembering what he had done made me think about a different time. In the spring of 1967, I was 18, and students marched on the campus of the University of Wisconsin in Madison to protest the Vietnam War. After vigorous debate, things quieted down, and I thought, this is the way disputes are resolved. In the fall of 1967, students marched to protest recruiting by Dow Chemical Company. 74 were injured, and what I remember is the reek of tear gas, and thinking, this isn't how it's supposed to be. In 1968, I was 19, and I woke up in my dorm room to the news of the murders of Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy. The remembered smell of tear gas was vivid as I watched the television coverage of the demonstrations at the Democratic Convention in Chicago, and I was thinking, this makes me angry. Who can justify this? In 1969, I was 20, and watched the nightly news as we learned about the My Lai massacre in Vietnam, and I thought, this doesn't just make me angry. This is evil. How can we have come to this? And in the spring of 1970, I was 21 when the students died on the campus of Kent State, and the evil continued. Suddenly, to me, it was absolutely clear. The authorities were wrong and the protesters were right. The world was black and white. In August of 1970, I snapped on the radio as I was driving cross-country to a friend's wedding. On the news, I learned that four young men had exploded a bomb outside the Army Math Research Center in Sterling Hall on the University of Wisconsin campus, back home in Madison. A young researcher named Robert Fasnacht, working late that night, died. And I thought, the world has just become gray again. The devil was closer to home, and I began to learn that in the real world, no one is all wrong or all right. So why did people have to die to teach a generation of kids that lesson? Oh, don't get me wrong. Several decades have passed, and I believe absolutely in the right to protest. I believe absolutely in the need to protest. I just don't believe absolutely anymore that anything is black and white. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. There's a biblical concept we've been talking about this hour, redemption. The dictionary defines it as deliverance from sin, atonement for guilt. But are there, or should there be, limits to the kinds of sins that can be redeemed? And what about mass murder? One of the warlords who terrorized Liberia during the country's 14-year civil war was a man who called himself General Butt Naked. He ran a brigade of child soldiers, most of whom he'd kidnapped and taught to rape, cannibalize, and torture. In 1996, General Butt Naked converted to Christianity and laid down his weapons. Today, he goes by the name Joshua Milton Blahi. And with the war in Liberia over, he's traveling the country as a preacher, asking for forgiveness from his victims. Filmmakers Danielle Anastasian and Eric Strauss spent 5 years following Blahi around Liberia, making a documentary called The Redemption of General Butt Naked. And Strange Chimps wanted to know if it's really possible for a man who's admitted to 20,000 crimes against humanity to change.
Absolutely, and not only is it possible, but if somebody attempts to make a change like this, how does that play out in the real world? It's such a sea change. It's really difficult to wrap your mind around any kind of claim of transformation that large. And as you watch the film, as he engages in these everyday acts of begging for forgiveness from his victims, you're constantly trying to sort of reconcile what he did in the past with what he's trying to be now. And it's incredibly, incredibly challenging.
So how did this happen, that a guy who was, in a sense, raised to be a warlord turned around, walked away, and now seems to be genuinely asking for forgiveness?
What happened to General Butt Naked and what really was the, you know, the stimulus for his transformation really fell down to, you know, really came down to one man named Pastor John Kunkun, who was an evangelical preacher, minister at the time in, and still is, he's a bishop today, during the mid-90s, in 1996. And he was a part of a group of evangelical preachers who were attempting to have an effect on the conflict, a positive effect to end the conflict that was really ravaging their country at the time. I mean, this was at the height, 1996 was really at the height of much of the conflict in Liberia. And as Pastor Kuhn tells it, you know, these men decided to reach out to the warlords to try to speak to the warlords and tell them what they were doing was, you know, they weren't the heroes they saw themselves as, defending their ethnic group or their people, if you will. They were perpetrating atrocities across the nation and causing, you know, mass suffering. So these preachers, and they were very, you know, in many ways extremely courageous men, went out into the front lines, and Pastor Kuhn went to this area of Monrovia that was controlled by General Butt Naked and his fighters, and approached him, just walked right up and entered his headquarters and spoke boldly to General Butt Naked and told him, you know, that what he was doing was, to use Pastor Kuhn's vocabulary, a sin and a crime, you know, in the eyes of God. And that really became, that moment between those two men became the beginning of the end for the persona of General Butt Naked. It was after that moment and a series of meetings that would continue to happen between these two men that led General Butt Naked to lay down his weapons and depart from the front line in late 1996 and become Joshua Milton Blahi, which is what he goes by today.
And, I mean, I suppose he could have just walked away, disappeared somewhere, made a new life under a completely new name. He didn't choose to do that.
When he did walk away, there was a lot of pressure for him to rejoin the war. The war kind of died down soon after his conversion, and then it sort of ramped back up for a second phase. And during that second phase, there was a lot of pressure from members of the Kron tribe and other political figures that he was involved with for him to rejoin the fighting. So he went into exile, he got married, he started a family, and he tried to stay as far away from the fighting in Liberia as possible to avoid any temptation of kind of sliding back into his old persona. So he spent several years outside of Liberia. And our film really picks up when he decides to return. He was living in exile in the Budaburam refugee camp in Ghana, where a number of Liberian refugees still live today. We sort of follow him from his journey from Budaburam back to Liberia, where he attempts to reconcile with a lot of his victims' families.
Why does he want to do this?
I mean, this is really, in many ways, a lot of, hopefully, what our film is challenging our audience to think about, to acknowledge. I don't think there's an easy answer for that. I mean, if you were to listen to Blahi say it, he claims to have a full understanding of Christianity, of his new faith, and what he needs to do to truly become a Christian and to truly put down that persona of General Butt Naked. I think he acknowledges that he can never truly balance the scales of his past, but in his words, he believes that, you know, this is the only way to sort of, the only way to truly be a Christian is to continue on that journey, attempting to balance the scales of his past. And of course, what Danielle and I try to put forth in the film is if that is even possible, and number one, and also to really examine a man like Blahi's motivations. And I think that becomes worth looking at when you see him engage with these, you know, his former victims, when you see him make his way across Liberia, when you see what happens to him when the Truth and Reconciliation Commission comes to Liberia. You know, we sort of judge him through his actions and present him through his actions, not just his words. And it becomes a much more complicated understanding of a man and his motivations.
Sorry, I didn't mean to kill your brother. You know that's war. I'm sorry. I'm sorry, man. I beg you. Forgive me. No, don't just go like that. I beg you. bake you something.
I'm already happy.
I kill your brother out of madness. But please, I will be able to play the brother for you. I may not be able to do everything that your brother can do, but I will stand there whenever you need a brotherly counsel. Whenever you need a brotherly protection, try to call on me. I beg you, please. It's the toughest moment in my life to see somebody who I hurt in the past. She's still crying. I killed her brother.
Where'd she go?
I shot him, and you know, chopped him dead. Now, when she reminded me, I felt so evil. Sorry. I killed their brothers, killed their sisters, raped them, crippled them. They are right not to forgive me.
When he's trying to apologize, I mean, there's a moment in the film when he's talking to a woman and he says, "I'm sorry I killed your brother. I didn't mean to." Well, yes, he did mean to, don't you think? I mean, he killed people on purpose.
Yeah, I mean, I think that in moments like that, you get a sense of his real struggle with his past actions. And I think in the film itself, in the beginning of the film, that moment where he's approached this woman and he's apologizing for the crimes that he committed in the past, you can see that he's really struggling to find a way to interact with these people, and he can come across as very belligerent in some ways. You know, at one point he uses the language, "You have to forgive me."
He's putting a lot of pressure on her to forgive him, and as a viewer, I mean, I sort of feel like that's not something he's entitled to ask for.
Sure, and it's absolutely very uncomfortable.
What was the most moving of those for you?
One moment that was perhaps the most moving for me, or one of the reconciliation moments, was when Blahi approached Lovetta and her daughter. Because I think that initially you think of these reconciliation moments as about Blahi, but as you really spend time and you witness them and you witness the hurt and the pain that has happened to these Liberians, I think in the end that those moments are truly about the victims. And Blahi is not really what is important to us at those moments in many ways. It is the healing that is taking place, hopefully, for those victims, that ability to peace with their past and confront it, you know, in the face of Blahi and move beyond it and heal. And I think for me, when Lovetta's daughter was confronted with Blahi, you know, you see her on camera crying. And I, at the time that Danielle and I were shooting, just assumed, you know, this poor girl, you know, she's terrified. You know, this man who murdered her, or this man's army murdered her father and caused, you know, wounded her for life. And she's crying. And I just assumed it was from fear. But later she said that she was crying because it touched her to see someone who had hurt her come forward and beg for her forgiveness. As a non-Liberian, as a Westerner, my mind, the way I necessarily understand justice and forgiveness, I never would have went there in my mind. I don't think I would have sat there if I had been the wounded party and had a thought like that. And that touched me. I mean, this was a girl who was 14, 15 years old, and I thought that was an extremely profound way to approach, you know, reconciliation and healing.
So does it make a difference for the victims, a permanent difference, do you think, when Blahi comes up and when they can confront him and when he can say he's sorry?
Yeah, I mean, I think to some extent, regardless of whether or not we believe Blahi, you notice that a lot of the victims that he approaches are sort of using the situation for their own means, for their own ability to heal and move beyond the past. I mean, they certainly don't expect a perfect man before them. But DeConso, who we continue to be in touch with, has expressed numerous times that just the ability to meet Blahi and to experience that moment of reconciliation was kind of like a weight lifted off of his shoulders. The ability to forgive for him was extremely beneficial on a psychological level, regardless of whether or not Blahi actually deserves it. And, you know, that's something that viewers will make their own judgments and reserve for themselves. But it is undeniable that the ability to bestow forgiveness on somebody can have really powerful effects for the person who's doing it.
Blahi does also has reached out and is doing a fair amount of work with some of the former child soldiers, you know, people he kidnapped or brought into his army, hooked on drugs, taught to fight. He says that he's the one who should do it. Do you agree?
I think this is a more, you know, this is one of those extremely complicated issues. Because as you see in the film, you know, Danielle and I were there witnessing Blahi reaching out to former fighters of all the different factions, attempting to act as a role model for them and show them that you can change, you can, in Blahi's words, you know, he accepted Christianity and is, you know, acting as a preacher, attempting to turn these young men's lives around, bring them out of the slums and the ghettos where they're involved in drugs and crime and turn their lives around. And on the one hand, that's extremely admirable. And in many ways, Blahi is very well placed to do that since, you know, as many of the fighters have said to Danielle and I, and they say in the film, as bad as they were, he was worse. So to see someone like that be able to pull himself out of a sense of guilt at what they've done and move on with their lives and reach out to people, he is a powerful symbol to those young men. Simultaneously, though, I think it's also very uncomfortable to witness Blahi sort of reassuming a position of power with these young men. You know, there is a scene in the Victory Church where he is encouraging and getting these men, all of these young men worked up about changing their lives, but it is somewhat, you know, frighteningly reminiscent of what he must have been like on the streets of Monrovia in 1996 as General Butt Naked, kind of working up these young men to commit atrocities. And I think that's where that uncomfortable moment lies. And it kind of brings us back again to reexamining Blahi's, you know, motivations. Is this a guy who put down one sort of you know, means to power and has picked up another? I mean, what is really motivating him at these moments? Because it is a very uncomfortable place for a figure like him to be in again.
I want to tell you something this morning. This very nation that has rejected you. This very citizen that said nothing good come out of you. I stay in the name of the Lord this morning. I say, go show yourself to Liberia. I stand before you this hour. Show yourself to your family. Go show yourself to the society. I command you this morning, in the name of the Lord, in the mighty name of the Lord, that you will go and they will see no limitation in you. I declare that limitation of your broken. I declare it broken. I declare it destroyed by the power in the mighty name of Jesus.
Do you like him?
That's a good question. I mean, I think in some ways, I think that the question itself, you know, the reality of the situation is a little bit bigger than that. I mean, it's hard to sort of distill it down to, you know, whether or not you like somebody. I mean, he is a perpetrator of atrocities, and it's kind of hard to get around that on some level, but he can be a very likable person to be around. But every time you might begin to feel that way, your mind sort of automatically wanders back to what it is he did, and that always presents a certain level of discomfort.
I would also, you know, I completely agree with Danielle on that and say that on many levels, it's not really an issue of like. I mean, is he a likable guy? Yeah. Are there moments when we get on with him? Yeah. We spent 5 years documenting his journey. At the end of the day, though, it gets to the issue of, is he genuine or not as well? I mean, is he likable? Sure. Does it matter? You know, I'm not sure it necessarily does. At the end of the day, he is guilty of these crimes. And that takes us to another step, which is, you know, is the issue of justice. You know, again, is he genuine or not? Is he sincere or not? Even if he is, that only takes you so far in the questions surrounding individuals like Blahi and other Liberian perpetrators.
Redemption is at the heart of this film. What does redemption mean to you?
I think that I've come to understand throughout the process of making of this film the idea of redemption as a process. It's not an absolute place or a state of being. Bishop John Kunkun, who we spoke to in the film, actually kind of makes this point that it is a journey. It's not a place that you can arrive at. And that's very much how I see Joshua Blahi, his attempts at reconciliation. The redemption of General Butt Naked is not a fact. It's more a process, sort of a state of attempting to, you know, right the wrongs of his past. And I don't think that, you know, in my mind, I don't feel that it's so much that he's achieved redemption, but he's attempting to. And it really remains to be seen through his actions. You know, will he continue to stay on the path that he's chosen and continue to sort of develop, or will he sort of fall back into kind of a more selfish motive?
Daniel Anastasian and Eric Strauss directed The Redemption of General Butt Naked. Anne Strangsham spoke with them. Say Something About Child's Play, a poem by Nigerian Chris Albani. The soldier asks the boy, "Choose, which do I cleave, your right arm or left?" The boy, 10, maybe 9, says, "Neither. Or when I play like a bird with a broken wing, I will smudge the line of the hopscotch square. Let the darkness in." The soldier asks again, "Choose, which do I cleave, your right leg or left?" Older in this moment than his dead father, the boy says, "Neither. Or when I dance the spirit dance, I will stumble, kick sand in the face of light." The boy says, "Take my right eye. It has seen too much. But leave me the left. I will need it to see God." It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. For more information on Sympathy for the Devil, please go to our website at ttbook.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.